Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is another USMLE podcast. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that this is episode 293. So we'll be starting a review series for step for the USMLE exams. I mean, this is going to be useful to anyone taking anywhere from step one all the way to step three. It's going to be a review of gastroenterology, although some things I would say will be more attuned to people that are studying for step one. But again, I think if you're studying for any of the USMLE exams, you should find this to be pretty helpful. So we'll just make this in short bits and pieces, but we're going to just keep chugging along. Okay, so this is again episode 293. So let's just get right into it. Right, the thing with gastroenterology that's pretty annoying is there's really not much, you know, like pharm or phys behind it. It's mostly just a lot of pathologies. But again, the thing is, if you pay attention, I'm going to use a lot of cases, a lot of vignettes to highlight many of the core concepts. And then I'm going to try to make some integrations across multiple disciplines. Right. Again, a lot of it is also, a lot of it is also a pattern recognition. Right. So just things to keep in mind. But again, I don't think it's going to be too daunting. It's pretty straightforward if you kind of understand what's going on. And again, if there is understanding that's necessary for a particular area or is available for a particular area, chances are I'll probably go over it. Right. So the thing is, let's just start with some anatomy and embryology. Right. So the thing is, for those of you that are taking step one, right? So this is not applicable to people taking step two, CK, step three. Well, if you're going into a surgery rotation, they may pimp you on this on a surgery rotation, right? But remember, you want to make sure you know your layers of the abdominal wall, right? Again, it's just something that's pretty high to know, right? Remember, if you start from the skin, right? From your skin, you have your superficial fascia, right? And then remember, your superficial fascia includes your campers and your scapular fascia. Right. And then you go to the oblique muscles. Right. So obviously the one that should come first should be the external oblique muscle. And then after that, you should have the internal oblique muscle. Right. And then after that, you have like transversus abdominis. You have your transversalis fascia. Right. And then you have your extraperitoneal fascia. And then you get to the parietal peritoneum. Right. So again, it's not too hard to memorize. Right. Again, skin, superficial fascia. And then remember, your superficial fascia has two parts. Right. Campers fascia and scapular fascia. Right. And then you're going to your oblique muscles. Obviously, the one that should come first should be external before internal oblique. Right. And then you have your two T's. Right. You have your transversus abdominis. And if you're going in alphabetical order, it kind of helps. Right. Transversus abdominis and then transversalis fascia. Right. And then after that, you go to your extraperitoneal fascia and then boom, you go to your parietal peritoneum. Right. Remember, your visceral peritoneum is the thing that directly lines the walls of your GI organs. Right. And obviously your GI tract, you know, has three parts. Right. There's the foregut, there's the midgut, there's the hindgut. Basically, if you wanted to divide them up, your foregut basically extends all the way up to the ligament of trites. And then, so that's a part, obviously a part of the duodenum. And then from that part of the duodenum, if you go all the way to the proximal 2/3 of the transverse colon, that's your midgut, right? And then everything from the distal third of your transverse colon all the way to like your rectum is going to be your hindgut, right? So again, your foregut, again, basically the first half of your duodenum, your stomach is there, your liver, basically all those things around the stomach and the intestines are pretty much foregut derived, right? So remember, again, like your duodenum, your stomach, your liver, your gallbladder, your esophagus, right? Those are all called part of the foregut, right? And again, remember, these things are all derived from endoderm for the most part on NBM exams. And don't forget, right, your celiac trunk is the blood supply, right? Your celiac trunk is the blood supply for your foregut. I remember I made a podcast, I think it's one of my podcasts in the 100s, maybe like 180 something or whatever. I would encourage you to listen to it. I call it like the vascular podcast. Basically, I go into the higher blood vessels and the way your friends at the NBME love to integrate those things. And then, remember again, like I said, again, I'm going to be doing like some kind of targeted repetition so that it's easy to remember these factoids that I'm discussing. Again, anatomy and embryology, unfortunately, a lot of it is just a lot of memorization. But remember your midgut, right? It goes from your distal duodenum, right? To the proximal 2/3 of the transverse colon. And remember, the blood supply of this, right, is your superior mesenteric artery, right? Your superior mesenteric artery is a big blood supply, right? And one thing your friends at the NBME can do, right, is they can give you a question about a person that has a history of AFib, right? Or the person had a recent MI. And then they tell you that, oh, this person has sudden onset severe abdominal pain, right? And it's very non-specific, right? And the person may even have signs of peritonitis, and they're asking you for the diagnosis. Well, I'd hope you're thinking about acute mesenteric ischemia, right? So the thing that pretty much happened is that these people, essentially, they formed a clot in the heart because they have AFib. Remember, the left atrium is kind of quivering at that point, right? Or they have a recent MI, they formed a clot in one of the ventricles. And then that thing flicks off, goes into the systemic circulation, and occludes the superior mesenteric artery, right? The most common cause is very high yield. The most commonly impaired vessel, blood vessel in a person with acute mesenteric artery, well, with acute mesenteric ischemia, is actually going to be the superior mesenteric artery, right? And again, you notice their symptoms are acute. It's not something that arises over weeks, over months. No, right? If it's over weeks, it's over months, then it's not going to be acute mesenteric ischemia, right? So again, don't forget, in NBME questions, pay attention to your timelines. That's usually a smart thing to do. And then remember your hind gut, right? Again, basically, is everything from, again, your distal third of the transverse colon all the way to the rectum, right? And again, we're talking about this transverse colon so much. I remember that the transverse colon, they can give you a question about a person that, you know, recently completed antibiotic therapy for some disorder, right? And then you notice that this person has been having like severe abdominal pain, has been having a lot of diarrhea, right? If you see that, I would really hope you're thinking about C. diff colitis, right? Now, the thing is, how does C. diff colitis relate to the transverse colon? Well, they can give you a question about a person that has C. diff colitis, or they can even make this a question about a person that has like ulcerative colitis, and they tell you that, oh, this person, or even Chagas disease, believe it or not, right? Chagas disease can also cause this complication, and they'll tell you that the person for the last like few hours has been having like very severe abdominal pain, and then they'll tell you that they obtain like an abdominal x-ray, and you notice that the person has marked dilation of the transverse colon, right? They tell you that, oh, it's more than 6 centimeters in diameter. If you see that, I really hope you're thinking about toxic megacolon, right? I hope you're thinking about toxic megacolon. Remember, toxic megacolon is a well-established complication of C. diff colitis. It's a well-established complication of ulcerative colitis. It's a well-established complication on NBM exams of trypanosoma cruzii. Remember, T. cruzii causes big problems, right? It can cause achalasia, it can cause a dilated esophagus, right? It can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So that can present as heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. It can cause Hirschsprung's disease because it can destroy your nerve plexi in the distal colon, right? And remember, the transverse colon is sort of kind of tending towards the distal colon, right? So they can give you a question about a person that has toxic megacolon from South America, right? If you see stuff like that, I want you to think about Chagas disease caused by, again, Trypanosoma cruzii, right? And then remember, again, as I said, that the distal third of the transverse colon all the way to the rectum has the inferior is the hindgut. Remember, it has the inferior mesenteric artery as its blood supply, right? And then the thing is, the organs of your gut, it's not like they are just some mishmash that's just kind of sandwiched into your GI tract. No, that's ridiculous, right? Or like someone just opened your belly, tossed a bunch of organs there. No. Those organs, I kind of think of it as, for those of you listening to this stuff, to this podcast that are from Africa, right? You probably know, washer and dryer. At least I remember when I was little, who could afford a washer and dryer? I know for a fact that, whenever I would wash clothes, right? Again, even who has the washing machine? So you hand wash your clothes, you hand wash those clothes, you want them to dry. You basically have ropes that are outside your home. And then you literally put those clothes on those ropes, and then you put like pegs or pins on them to pretty much hold them to those ropes so that they can dry, under the sun or whatever, right? So the thing is, your GI organs almost have like ropes that are suspending them, right? Those ropes are called mesentery, right? Those ropes are called mesentery. The mesentery that suspends your GI tract, those ropes that suspends the different organs of your GI tract, they actually derive from mesoderm. That's very high yield to know, right? In fact, one factoid that your friends at the NBME love to test a lot is that the falciform ligament. Remember the falciform ligament, F-A-L-C-I-F-O-R-M, right? Is kind of around the liver, right? It's actually derived from a ventral mesentery, right? So again, don't forget, arterial supply of your foregut is the celiac artery, right? Arterial supply of your midgut is the superior mesenteric artery. And then arterial supply of your hindgut is the inferior. So foregut is your celiac artery. Midgut is your superior mesenteric artery. And then hindgut is your inferior mesenteric artery, right? And remember that ultimately all of your gut drains into the liver, right? Through the portal vein, right? Drains into your liver through the portal vein. And don't forget that, again, the fact that all your gut, like your foregut, mid gut, hind gut, for the most part, drains into the liver. That can tell you why people that have carcinoid syndrome, right, if they have just the GI malignant, if they have the malignancy just in their GI tract, usually in the appendix or in the small intestine, they won't have symptoms, right? Because again, all those parts of the GI tract, they all drain into the portal vein. When you drain into the portal vein, the liver has the ability to metabolize that serotonin, right? It'll metabolize that serotonin, right? So it will not be able to make its way to the right side of the heart. So those people, for the most part, will not have any significant symptoms. But then, if that malignancy metastasizes to the liver, right, then that promptly becomes a problem, right? Because you've essentially bypassed that portal circulation, so you've bypassed the metabolic activity of the liver. So those people can then begin to have right-sided heart symptoms, right? And remember, usually, those right-sided heart symptoms will be things like tricuspid regurg and pulmonic stenosis, right? There's a nice mnemonic there, TIPS, that is in many resources that you can use to memorize that, right? So like the TI is for tricuspid insufficiency, and then the PS is for pulmonic stenosis, right? So again, these are just all high-yield things to keep at the back of your mind. And then another little tidbit of anatomical detail, right? Like your retroperitoneal organs, you know, you kind of need to know these things, right? So remember, your retroperitoneal organs are things like your, you know, there's this mnemonic that I love using, Satpucker. Many of us have heard of this, right? So remember, your suprarenal glands, right? Your adrenal glands are retroperitoneal organs. And then your ureter and your inferior vena cava, right? Those are both retroperitoneal organs as well. Your duodenum, but it's not every part of the duodenum. It's the second and the third parts of the duodenum, right? That are retroperitoneal, right? And then remember, your pancreas, your ureters, right? Your ureters, your colon. Again, not every part of your colon. It's your ascending and your descending colon that are retroperitoneal, right? And then your kidneys are also retroperitoneal. Again, they're kind of in the back of the body, right? That's why we, whenever we're checking for a kidney infection or a kidney stone, we can try to check a CVE tenderness, right? Costovertebral angle tenderness, by literally tapping on the person's back, right? So the kidneys are in the back, right? They are retroperitoneal organs. And then your esophagus and your rectum are also retroperitoneal organs, right? So what are some high-yield things your friends at the MBA may love to test with regards to the term retroperitoneal? Well, the first thing is you got to know what these organs are, right? But then the second thing that pops up quite a bit on exams is they can give you a question about a person that, you know, presented with a myocardial infarction, and then the person had to get some kind of you know, had to be taken to the cath lab, went for some cardiac catheterization. And then they tell you that, oh, that they inserted something, you know, through the person's like arm or whatever, right? You know, to do the cardiac cath. Or they may have done like, actually, let me tell you this. Because if you're doing a cardiac cath, you can go in through the radial arteries. But another thing which, you know, many people don't do, right? Or you can go through the femoral arteries, right? So many times people do a femoral puncture to do a cardiac cath, right? Because, you know, if you go through the femoral arteries, you can sneak it all the way to the ureter and then go through the aortic sinus and go to the coronary arteries, right? That's how people do cardiac cath, right? And then they tell you that, oh, after like a few hours after this cardiac cath or a few days after, but usually it's a few hours after, the person becomes like profoundly hypotensive, the person's hemoglobin is dropping significantly, and then they are asking you for your diagnosis. If you see that, I really want you to think about a retroperitoneal bleed. Okay, you want to think about a retroperitoneal bleed. Remember, the ureter is a retroperitoneal organ, right? So the thing that potentially must have happened, is you may have punctured the ureter, right? And if you puncture the ureter, it's not going to end very well for a person, right? So the person can have a retroperitoneal bleed. So for those of you that are taking step 2 CK, step 3, they may say, oh, what's your next best step in management? The next best step for you is to perform CT angiography, right? And that's going to show you the bleed. And then you can actually do like some embolization, so you can try to control the bleed angiographically, right? That's something that's usually done by interventional radiology in the real world, right? So again, just things to keep in mind. And then another thing you also want to keep at the back of your mind is they can give you a question about a person that has like, they love to test this weird association between IgG4 related diseases and GI pathologies, right? If you see that, don't forget retroperitoneal fibrosis. Retroperitoneal fibrosis is one of those weird, bizarre things that also happens in people that have IgG4 related disease. IgG4 related disease is just disease where people, for some reason, they have fibrosis of weird organs in the body. They have like weird autoimmune problems, right? And when you check those people's serum, they have elevated levels of a specific kind of IgG called IgG4, right? So those people, they can have retroperitoneal fibrosis. That's a high yield association to know. Another thing they can also have is they can have autoimmune pancreatitis, right? So they can, those antibodies can begin to attack the pancreas, right? They can also make autoantibodies against their gallbladders, right? So they can have like an autoimmune cholecystitis, right? And then it's very high yield to know that these people, they can actually give you a question where they tell you that this person has a painless rock hard thyroid. I'll say that again. This person has a painless rock hard thyroid. If you see that, I want you to think about Riedel's thyroiditis, right? Riedel's thyroiditis. That's a very classic pathology that's common in people that have IgG4 related disease, right? Now, for those of you taking step one, right? Again, what are some other weird things they love to test with? Like, again, like anatomy and stuff of the GI tract. And again, I'll actually introduce some step two CK integrations. That's why you see I'm just calling this a gastroenterology review, right? So, like, it'll be useful for anyone studying from step one all the way to step three. I feel like for those of you taking step two CK, step three, if you actually kind of listen to these step one parts, it will help you understand quite a bit of pathophysiology so that the stuff you're learning for step two CK and step three will become like a joke to you. It'll become like very easy because you actually understand like what in the world is going on. And as you're seeing, I'm going to keep making a lot of integrations, right? So it's almost like I'm just cutting across everything all the way from step one to step three. But again, it'll be useful for anyone that's in med school that's going to be taking any of these USMLE exams. And for those of you that are taking step one, some of this step two, CK, step three stuff that I'm supposedly mentioning, believe it or not, some of those things have started showing up on the more recent exams. Because again, step one, they're trying to make it as clinical as possible, right? Because that's the big issue that many people have had with it, that oh, it's just a memorization based exam, doesn't have much clinical relevance, blah 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 blah, right? It does have clinical relevance, right? And as you'll see, if you learn the clinical context behind many of these pathologies, a lot of it is just a lot easier for you to pick up. And again, it will also benefit you as you kind of roll into your third year, okay, your clinical rotation. So how do we reabsorb many of these key, I'm not going to talk about how you reabsorb every single thing, right? But let's talk about some key high yield things that are reabsorbed in the GI tract, right? So the first one are carbs, right? So we know that digestion of carbohydrates, right, begins in the mouth, right? We know it all starts in the mouth with salivary amylase, right? So again, this is what is one way your friends at the MBA may love to go after this concept. Well, they love to go after this concept in seeing if you can pick the most sensitive test, the more sensitive lab marker for the diagnosis of acute pancreatitis, right? So remember, in acute pancreatitis, the person's amylase will be elevated and the person's lipase will also be elevated, right? So which one is more sensitive? It's going to be the lipase, right? Because again, remember, lipase pretty much comes from your pancreas for the most part, although it can come from other parts of your body, but the pancreas is the big one. But amylase can be elevated for many different reasons, right? So it may be elevated because you have acute pancreatitis, but it can also be elevated because you have a lot of vomiting, right? So they can give you a question about a person that has anorexia nervosa and say, oh, which of the following will be most likely elevated in this patient? Pick amylase, right? Pick amylase, because people that have anorexia nervosa, right? You know, if they puke as their preferred method of getting rid of nutrients and stuff, right? The amylase is going to go up, right? So again, remember, amylase can come from the saliva, from your salivary glands, but it can also come from your pancreas, right? But lipase is more specific in the diagnosis of acute pancreatitis, right? So for carbohydrates, right, remember, you begin that digestion in the mouth with salivary amylase. And then when you get to the small intestine, right, we have these disaccharidases, right? They are disaccharidases. You literally find them on the brush border of the small intestine. They essentially break down these disaccharides to monosaccharides, right? They break down these disaccharides to monosaccharides. So what's one pathology your friends at the MBME can introduce here? Well, they can give you a question about a person that has a lot of bloating and a lot of diarrhea that is temporarily associated with the consumption of food. Right, that is temporarily associated with the consumption of food. If you see that, you want to think about a lactase deficiency. I'll say that again. If you see that, you want to think about a lactase deficiency, right? Remember, lactase deficiency, these people usually not have any physical exam abnormalities. They will not have any lab abnormalities. If you see physical exam or lab abnormalities, that excludes lactase deficiency as your diagnosis on an MBM exam. Right? So that can be lactase deficiency. And sometimes people can have like almost like an acquired lactase deficiency after they have like a really, really bad gastroenteritis on an MBM exam. Right? So again, remember those disaccharidases, you find them on the surface of the GI tract, right? You find them on your brush border. You find them around your microvilli, right? So they literally break down those disaccharides to monosaccharides, right? And then one of the thing that your friends at the MBME can integrate on MBME exams is there's a particular kind of disaccharides that is known as alpha-glucosides, right? It's known as alpha-glucosides. So what's the deal with alpha-glucosides? The thing with alpha-glucosides is that it's a disaccharides that helps you break down some of your carbohydrates. But the thing is, there's some pharmacology associated with it, right? Especially if you're trying to treat a person that has diabetes, you can actually prevent them from reabsorbing that disaccharide, right? You can prevent them from reabsorbing that disaccharide, right? So if you, because remember, your body cannot reabsorb disaccharides. It can only reabsorb monosaccharides, right? So if you inhibited a disaccharides, then that glucose or whatever will hang out in your GI tract, in the lumen of your GI tract. And then, I mean, the disaccharide will hang out in the lumen of your GI tract. And those disaccharides, right, they have a ton of OH groups, a lot of hydroxy groups. So they are very osmotically active, right? So because they're osmotically active, they're going to draw a lot of water into the lumen of the GI tract. So, you know, you're pretty much preventing the reabsorption of sugar. So that's good for diabetes, right? But you can already begin to see that those things can cause some other problems, right? I mean, those people like this, you don't want to sit close to them on a plane ride. You don't want to sit close to them on a train or something, right? Because those people, they're almost like biological weapons in and of themselves, right? I mean, they're farting and all these things, right? Because they're pretty much going to have a diarrhea. They're going to have flatulence and all those things, right? So what are the diabetes drugs that work as alpha-glucosides inhibitors? The alpha-glucosides inhibitors, you should be thinking about things like acarbose and miglitol, right? Acarbose, A-C-A-R-B-O-S-E, acarbose and miglitol, right? Those are alpha-glucosides inhibitors that are used to treat diabetes, right? So we said that, okay, so let's kind of get back on track here, right? So we said that these disaccharides, they break the disaccharides into monosaccharides, right? So how do you reabsorb that stuff, right? Well, on the apex, right? The lumen, right? The lumen side of the GI tract, right? Remember, we have SGLT transporters, right? Those SGLT transporters, they work for all monosaccharides. But on that apex, there is actually a specific kind of transporter that helps you reabsorb fructose, right? That helps you reabsorb fructose. Remember, fructose is actually reabsorbed on the apex, on the apical surface of the enterocytes of the GI tract, right? By GLUT5 transporters, right? By GLUT5 transporters. Remember, GLUT5 transporters, right, are also found in sperm, right? Remember, sperm uses fructose as its source of energy because, you know, it has to swim pretty energetically to get into that woman, right? And then also remember that those SGLT transporters, we don't just find them in the GI tract. We don't just find them on the surface of enterocytes of the GI tract. We can also find them in the nephra, right? Especially at the level of the proximal convoluted tubules. If you want to get a lot more specific here, you'll find them at the level of the you find the SGLT2 isoform, right, on the apex of the proximal convoluted tubules, right? So obviously, those SGLT2 transporters, what are they, right? So they're SGLT literally means sodium glucose linked transporter, right? Sodium glucose linked transporter, right? So what's the high yield thing your friends at the MBME love to test here across all the USMLEs? Well, remember that, first off, I guess maybe for people that are taking step one, the fact that it's a sodium glucose linked transporter, that means it's a transporter that takes advantage of the gradient energy of sodium to reabsorb glucose, right? It takes advantage of the gradient energy of sodium to reabsorb glucose. So what's that gradient energy, right? Remember, the sodium potassium ATPase pump, one thing it helps us do is it helps us pump 3 sodiums out of a cell and brings 2 potassiums into the cell, right? So it takes out 3 sodiums, brings in 2 potassiums. So the thing is, sodium is primarily an extracellular ion. So the thing is, when sodium flows from outside the cell, like the lumen of the proximal convoluted tubule, the urine side, all the way to the inside, right? It's flowing down its gradient. You can use that gradient, right, to move glucose against this concentration gradient from the lumen of the GI, from the lumen of the urine side of the proximal tubule, all the way to the intracellular space of the proximal convoluted tubule cells, right? So that's an example of secondary active transport. That's a high yield concept that your friends at the MBME love to test, right? So the thing is, if you wanted to be a diabetes drug, it probably makes sense that you can inhibit this SGLT2 transporter, right? So you can inhibit those transporters, right? You can use drugs, they all end in flozin, right? So drugs like canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, empagliflozin, right? Those are SGLT2 inhibitors that can help you pretty much reabsorb it, inhibit the SGLT2 transporter, right? So that you don't reabsorb that glucose, right? And that those drugs actually work pretty well. But again, you can already begin to see what the side effects of the drug can be, right? It can literally be something along the lines of, because think about it, all that sugar that's in your urine. Remember, there's bacteria in your urine to start, right? Obviously, you're going to have a great party. You're pretty much going to be organizing Thanksgiving for these bacteria because of all the sugar you're putting in your urine, right? So urinary tract infections are a key side effect of these drugs. In fact, the person that's diabetic, right, they can have like necrotizing fasciitis around like their, you know, like around your perineum from this drug, right? So they can have like Fournier's gangrene. Remember, Fournier's gangrene, F-O-U-R-N-I-E-R, right? Fournier's gangrene is basically neck fasc of a person's, so necrotizing fasciitis of a person's perineum, right? So that's a very well-established complication of these SGLT2 inhibitors, right? So that's something you want to keep at the back of your mind. They can even get like candidal, like vaginal infections and things like that, right? So remember, candidal infections, you know, cottage cheese appearance, pH of the vaginal secretion will be less than 4.5, right? So again, just want to keep those things at the back of your mind on exams. So again, let's go back to the enterocytes, right, of the GI tract for carb reabsorption, right? So we said carbs, right, on the apical surface. Again, we said all the monosaccharides, they are reabsorbed through SGLT transporters, right, on the apex of the enterocytes of the GI tract. And then remember, for fructose specifically on the apex, again, notice there's a big difference between the apex. The apex is the side facing the lumen. The basal side is the side that's facing the like your blood vessels, right? So essentially the thing that happens is, again, apex SGLT transporters help you reabsorb all monosaccharides. And then GLUT5 transporters, again, on the apex specifically helps you reabsorb fructose, right? But on the basal surface, right, we have these GLUT2 transporters, right? These GLUT2 transporters, they are the things that shuttle all your monosaccharides, including fructose, to the bloodstream, okay? On the basal surface, the GLUT2 transporters, right? Now, I said that for carbs, you can only reabsorb monosaccharides. That's kind of different for proteins, right? The thing is, for proteins, you actually have the ability to reabsorb dipeptides and tripeptides in the lumen of the GI tract, right? So how does protein digestion happen? Well, the first thing that happens is, you know, the pH of the stomach is pretty low, right? You know, it's around 2 because of those parietal cells that's making like a ton of acid through that hydrogen potassium antiporter, right? Remember, that's the thing that's inhibited by your proton pump inhibitor, like omeprazole, esomeprazole, lansoprazole, pantoprazole, right? All those prazoles, right? So that low stomach pH, right, you know, helps with the conversion of pepsinogen, which comes from chief cells, to pepsin, right? And then pepsin in the stomach, right? Remember, pepsinogen is the zymogen form, but pepsin is the active form, right? So that pepsin, its job is basically, it will break down proteins into amino acids, right? It will break down those proteins into amino acids. You know, if you break down those proteins into amino acids, you can reabsorb them in the enterocyte. This is actually one pathway of protein reabsorption, right? So, and remember, the kinds of amino acids that you have actually kind of depends on how they are reabsorbed, right? So the thing is, if you have like a neutral amino acid or a basic amino acid, that's actually reabsorbed by facilitated diffusion, right? So it diffuses down, but it does that in a facilitated fashion, right? So that means you need some kind of transporter to make that happen, right? But then for other kinds of amino acids, right? So basically other kinds of amino acids that are not neutral, that are not basic, you actually use like sodium-linked transport, right? So again, that gradient energy of sodium is really used a lot in secondary active transport of a ton of stuff in the GI tract, right? But then remember, protein digestion does not just only start in the stomach. You know, you can also have some stuff happen in the small intestine, right? So how does that happen, right? So remember, the pancreas, right, can, one of its enzymes it can release is something called trypsinogen, right? It can release trypsinogen. Again, that's a zymogen, so obviously it's going to be inactive. The thing with that trypsinogen is it can be converted by an enzyme known as enterokinase. And enterokinase will convert trypsinogen to trypsin. And then trypsin can actually help you digest protein. But one of the major things that your friends at the MBA may love to test that trypsin does is that it actually activates two other enzymes. It activates an enzyme called a carboxypeptidase. It also activates a peptidase, right? That tells you that, oh, this is something that probably breaks a, you know, peptide bonds, right? And then chymotrypsinogen is another zymogen that it also activates, right? And those things, again, help you break down proteins into amino acids. But again, remember... you know, this trypsinogen will come from the pancreas. It will come through the, you know, come to the duodenum through the sphincter of OD, right? So again, just high yield to know all those high yield things with regards to carbs and proteins. I guess I can also talk about fat reabsorption. I'll just talk about that and then I'm going to go ahead and stop because I want to keep these to roughly 30 minutes. Although I'll also talk about a step one course at the end that I'm holding on the 5th to the 9th of April next month. It's a 40-hour course, but let's finish this up first, right? So the fats, right? So how do we deal with fats? The thing is, fats are actually partially broken down in the antrum of the GI tract, right? But that's a minor pathway. What's the big thing that happens? Remember, your eye cells in the duodenum, right? They release an enzyme known as CCK, cholecystokinin, right? Cholecysto, right? So choly, that means it's something that targets, that goes after your gallbladder, right? So it goes to the gallbladder, right? So one of CCK basically has two jobs. First thing is it goes to your gallbladder, tells your gallbladder, okay, let's contract, quickie, right? And then you squirt out bile, right? You squirt out bile. But another thing it also does is it goes to your pancreas, right? CCK tells your pancreas to make lipase, right? To make lipase. I'll say that again. CCK goes to your pancreas and tells it to make lipase. It's very high yield to know for exams, right? And we can see why when people have like cholelithiasis, they try to avoid eating, because if they eat, those eye cells in the duodenum will see that fat, and then they're going to secrete cholecystokinin, and then that's going to cause, again, your gallbladder contract, and your gallbladder will contract on those rocks, and that's not going to be a very pleasant experience, right? The person is going to have a ton of pain, right? The person will basically be eating like a hermit until they can get that gallbladder removed, right? So what does lipase do, right? Remember, lipase, you know, it converts triglycerides. Remember, triglyceride, right? Literally, look at the name, triglyceride, right? Triglyceride. It's basically glycerol, which is an alcohol, right, that has a 3 hydroxy groups, right? For those of you that, you know, affectionately love organic chemistry, glycerol is essentially, if I'm not mistaken, propan 1-2-3 triol, right? I used to teach and tutor actually a ton of organic chemistry. I love OChem. It's a pretty fun subject, but that's a different conversation. But it contains glycerol, right? But instead of those OH groups, right, you strip off those hydrogen ions and then you put a ton of fatty acids, right? So triglycerides are basically glycerol and 3 fatty acids, right? So the lipase converts it to monoacylglycerol and 2 free fatty acids, right? So that means one of the fatty acids are still connected to the glycerol backbone, right? But then you'll form 2 free fatty acids, right? So monoacylglycerol, two free fatty acids, right? Those things form micelles, right? So the micelles, right? Those micelles, the thing that helps you, you know, kind of form them is bile, right? And then again, this fat is reabsorbed by enterocytes. But the thing is, because the thing is, a triglyceride cannot be reabsorbed, right? But if you have monoacylglycerol and these free fatty acids, absolutely, they can be reabsorbed, right? So they're reabsorbed by the enterocytes of the GI tract. But the thing is, once they get reabsorbed by the enterocytes of the GI tract, guess what? They're going to be remading to triglycerides, right? So it's almost like you break them down, right? So that they can go through, right? And then after you break them down so they can go through, right, they then get remade into triglycerides inside the enterocytes of the GI tract, right? That's actually done in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum of the enterocytes of the GI tract, right? Again, it's just some of these small, annoying, nagging details that your friends at the MBME, they love to test on exams, right? So they're remade into these triglycerides in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, right? So smooth endoplasmic reticulum is actually expressed pretty heavily, right, in the enterocytes of the GI tract, right? So, and then, you know, as they are made into triglycerides in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, your rough endoplasmic reticulum does not sit around, right? Your rough endoplasmic reticulum, you know, remember the fact that it's rough endoplasmic reticulum means it's endoplasmic reticulum that is studded with ribosomes, right? So at this point, you've transcribed and you've translated the gene for ApoB48. And then that ApoB48, you know, binds up with those triglycerides, right? And you form chylomicrons. And then those chylomicrons, right, they go into those lymphatic vessels. They go into those lacteals, lacteals, right? So they go into those lacteals, they are absorbed into the lymphatics, right? They go into the circulation, and then those things go to your peripheral cells, right? And then you have all this stuff that happens with cholesterol or metabolism with LCAT, ACAT, APOA1, APOC2, yada, 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 right? So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. And then again, I said I will speak to the courses I have coming up. Again, for those of you studying for step one, I have a 40-hour course that's coming up early next month. It's from the 5th to the 9th of April. It's a 5-day course, right? It's 40 hours. It's 8 hours each day. A very high yield course. Again, you'll learn a ton. We'll review about 4,000 concepts. Actually, it's going to be actually very likely more than that. About 4,000 concepts that are tested on the USMLE Step 1 exam. And again, for those of you that are either at the end of your dedicated period and you're about to take your exam, it'll be a very, very good way to just pull everything together for you in 5 days, over 40 hours, right? It's 8 hours each day. very intensive course. Or for those of you that are going into your dedicated periods, right? Again, in 40 hours, you'll pull everything together and it'll help you walk into your dedicated period with a very solid understanding of stuff, right? So what's the thing that's unique about this course compared with other courses that are available? Because again, I know there's a lot of step one courses available, but the thing that makes my courses unique is one, as many of you have seen from my podcast, I'm very good at integrating things across multiple disciplines. So that's something that's going to be happening a lot during the course. Two, I love to go with context. Again, I'm not just going to be giving you like, again, you see like a lot of what we did today was anatomy and embryology, right? But did you see me just spend my time just giving you factoids without context? No. I don't do that, right? So for me, I'm a very big believer in giving people context, in giving people an understanding, right? So I will not just teach you concepts. I will teach you those concepts in the context of how they will be tested on the USMLE exams, right? So I'll give you that context. I'll make different integrations, right? And a lot of what I'm going to be going over that day, I'm going to be going over clinical cases. I'm going to be going over vignettes, right? Again, that will highlight those contexts that your friends at the MBME love to go after. And obviously, I will spend a lot of time explaining pathophysiology, right? Again, I don't like just teaching people facts. I'm going to do a lot of explaining, right? So that you will come away with a very solid understanding of stuff, right? And then for those of you that are taking step 2 CK step 3, you're going to have a 16 and a half hour course taking place from the 25th to the 27th of this month, right, of March. And then on the 24th, I obviously have an MBME test taking strategies course that goes for 2.5 hours. So if you're interested in any of these courses, just shoot me an email through the website and I'll give you information on it. I'll give you information on payments, on how to pay and all that stuff. And once you make payments, you'll then be registered for the course. The course will be a group course. It'll be held over Zoom. And then please subscribe to the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And then also, I have these podcasts on Google Podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify. If you want to, please subscribe to them. I also have a YouTube channel where I have a bunch of videos, Divine Intervention, USMLE podcasts and videos. Please feel free to subscribe to those. Again, any bit of support, positive feedback definitely helps. And also just any corrections or things you would like me to change definitely helps. So I want to go over a life lesson real quick today. And this was actually something that I talked about in church yesterday, right? So, you know, by the grace of God, I get opportunities to preach in church because I, you know, as you can see from this podcast, I obviously love teaching. So, you know, I love to teach in church. So, you know, one thing I talked about in church yesterday, but I think it's pretty applicable to med students, right, is and people that are in healthcare, is the value of immediate obedience, right? So you see people, they keep kicking things down the curb, 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 right? And then as you keep kicking things down the curb, you're like, man, how am I, how do I keep failing? How do I keep not succeeding in life? How do I keep getting stressed? The thing is, many times, the stress that people go through in life, they kind of create it for themselves. Again, don't get me wrong, you know, people fall into unfortunate circumstances, you know, they lose a loved one, COVID-19 happens, you know, weird stuff happens. That's understandable. But I will tell you this, again, just having worked with thousands of students in my lifetime, I've seen this thing. A lot of people, they postpone things. They keep postponing. They don't do things at the right time, right? The thing is, if you do the right thing at the right time, you can achieve greatness with little stress, right? With relatively little stress. That's just the truth, right? Or you see people, they wait till the last minute. They are studying for step one. They wait till their school's dedicated period, and then they wonder how they are starting off and they're getting scores in the 150s on MBME practice exams. Again, it breaks my heart when I see people go through all these problems, because these are things that are largely avoidable, right? So take for example for me, right? When did I get into med school? You know, I got into Johns Hopkins, you know, by the grace of God in 2014, right? You know, I kind of had this figuring out phase of life, you know, we're studying anatomy, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's kind of intense, you know. At Hopkins then, anatomy was 7 weeks, right? Anatomy in 7 weeks with dissections and everything, it's pretty brutal, right? Although I learned a ton from my anatomy course. It was a very first rate course. But the thing is, after I kind of figured things out, you know, kind of like the first few months of med school, I think it was like 4 months. I was like, you know, let me just kind of get my feet under me and all that stuff. If I'm not mistaken, from January of 2015, which was like midway through my first year, I started studying for step one then, right? I started doing just longitudinal studying, right? I studied just, you know, on a I mean, did I do every day? No, but I was pretty consistent in what I was doing. You know, I studied pretty consistently for months, right? So when our school administered a CCSE exam, I was already doing really well. I was already above the average step one score on my CCSE exam, just to start, literally, right? So the thing is, and obviously, right, like my dedicated period was very relatively cush compared to what I see some people go through, right? All these things happen because I just chose, right? And these are things, right? Like, again, your life is defined quite a bit by your choices. It's not really defined by your background. I tell people this. There's this famous Nigerian musician that said this thing. He's a gospel musician. Don't let your background put your back to the ground, right? So the thing is, your background should not determine how far you go in life. Right? It's really like some of the choices you make that really determine how far you go in life, right? And one of those good choices I'm encouraging you to take today, right, is to do the right thing at the right time, right? You do the right thing at the right time. If you obey at the right time, if you do the right thing when you're supposed to do it, not like on a delayed schedule, right? Not procrastinating. You'll likely be able to succeed again with ease, right? Again, like, to be honest with you, many of my USMLE exams, it was not the 3-4 weeks before my exams that really made any big difference. No, the big difference had been made because in the place of doing the right thing at the right time, right? In the place of delayed gratification, I had made longitudinal commitments. And then I got the benefits of those things, right? So again, I know you may be like, man, Devon, you keep yapping over this thing. But you may say, why is it important to do the right thing at the right time? Well, the thing is, it really helps your mental health, right? You're not always stressed because you see a lot of med students, mental health crisis, again, for many different reasons. And again, I'm not here to judge anybody, right? Again, people go through, I mean, I've worked with med students that have had like losses of loved ones and all these things. That's true. But one thing that really contributes to stress amongst medical students and healthcare professionals is they don't do the right thing at the right time, right? And the thing is, when you're stressed, right, you're not going to be mentally okay. That's the truth. When you're stressed, you're not going to be mentally okay. It causes things like people becoming obese because of all that cortisol, right? Again, remember, cortisol is literally a stress hormone, right? So the thing is, but when you're at ease, when you're relaxed, because you've done the right thing at the right time, because you've done things in longitudinal fashion, because you've made long-term, long-range commitments, then you're not freaking out all the time, right? Again, did med school stress me out? Absolutely did. I'm not going to lie. Med school, especially med school at Johns Hopkins, it was really stressful. Although, again, by the way, it was a great experience. If you get accepted at Johns Hopkins, you should probably go there. It's a great med school. I mean, I've definitely seen the benefits in my life right now, but that's a different conversation. But basically, because I was not as stressed, right, I did not start panicking. I did not start becoming depressed or any of those things, right? Just because I did the right thing at the right time. Again, have I made mistakes in my life? Yes. Am I a perfect person? No, right? Again, remember, I'm a human being. I'm not Superman or whatever some people think I am. No, I'm a pretty basic, normal human being like all of you, right? But many of you, you can avoid many of some of these things that really stress people, right? Because there are many stressors in medical, but you can avoid some of them by just doing the right thing at the right time, right? Doing the right thing at the right time. Right? Start early, do the right thing, obey immediately, do the right thing immediately, right? Don't keep waiting, right? Even the Bible says that now is the time of salvation, not 10 years from now. It says now, today, if you hear my voice, right? Right? So now is the time of salvation, right? So do that thing now. Start preparing for step one now. Start preparing for step two CK now. Start preparing for step three now. Start preparing for your residency and training exams now, if you're a resident, right? So like just all these things, it will just help your life, right? And help you be successful. So thank you for listening to me yap away. I hope you found this podcast to be helpful. I'll see you in the next series. So again, this is Gastroenterology Series 1. Thank you for listening. God bless you. Goodbye.